like to do what is called the last lecture. So if you have one more chance in life to hear a lecture, you should hear him. Right? So hopefully that will be the last lecture for all of you. Unless you can speak.
Yeah, so the last lecture thing is a bogus because apparently you continue giving lectures after the last lecture. Anyway, I somehow thought I never need to teach anyway. We'll get to why that particular flowery title in a minute. So first of all, I'd like to thank Maria and DC Consortium chairs for asking me to do this. It's pretty daunting to actually try and tell people how to write good papers and give good talks. Very first question I guess I need to answer is why me? You know, why did I even feel presumptuous enough to accept when Maria asked? So this is the reason. I have students. I have been advising students for quite a long time, and 15 PhD students graduated with their dissertations, 25 graduated with their MS thesis, and furthermore, they have done quite well in terms of, I guess, writing their own papers and making their own career. So this guy, Menkes, is around here. He had an ICAP Best Dissertation Award, honorable mention, the planning conference 1 year. This other guy had the Best Dissertation Award another year. I think it's actually the same year. He won the award, and this guy got the honorable mention. This guy got a 10-year influential paper award, runner-up. And that guy got ICAPS 12 and FOX 12 Best Student Paper Awards. So if nothing else, I know people who seem to have done well, okay? You know, they had to deal with my advice on how to write papers and how to give talks. Since I didn't completely screw up their careers, I am trying to do the same advice for you and see if it might work for you. Okay? So that's the reason as to why I sort of agreed to do this. Now the next question is, what's this Wittgenstein deal and what's the Faraday's deal? How many of you know Wittgenstein? And you call yourself AI people? Okay. What's going on? Okay. So Wittgenstein, of course, is a famous philosopher, and the reason I'm particularly interested in putting him up there is he said the following in Tractatus Philosophicus, that what can be said at all can be said clearly. So he just robbed all of us of the luxury of saying, the stuff I'm doing is so hard that I can't explain it well. You know, it's really not my mistake that I cannot write well, it's just too hard to explain. And Wittgenstein said, anything at all that can be said clearly. So who better to use as a poster child for writing good papers than Wittgenstein, I thought. Okay, of course, he also said in this grayed out part that, and what we cannot talk about, we must pass over in silence. So if you ever think that what you're doing is so hard to explain well, just submit a white paper to each guy. Not white in the chart, white, just white paper, and see if it gets in. Okay, because I can't explain, so it should be just, you know, just give a blank page. Okay, so Wittgenstein is my poster child for writing good papers. Of course, I don't really know what he thought about, but you know, I thought, you know, he said this, so we'll use that. The other guy is Faraday. How many people know Faraday? Okay, well, so more physics people than AI people, but that's okay. Of course, you know Faraday for his work on electromagnetism, but one of the other things that you may not know about is he is one of the greatest popularizers of science. Okay, he used to give these evening lectures in Royal Society, and they were attended by everybody, and he used to make things that he's doing accessible to all these lay people. Okay, male royalty probably. And so he used to take talks seriously. And he said the following thing about talks. He said, the lecturer should give the audience full reason to believe that all his powers have been exerted for their pleasure and instruction. So you have to put all of yourself into your talks. This guy took talks seriously. So I thought he's the right guy to use as the poster child for giving good talks. Okay, and then what's all this business about milk-fed researchers? If you are lactose intolerant, don't be worried. Those of you who are not from, for whom English is not their native tongue, milk-fed typically just means beginning, you know, young. Okay, so for the young researchers, for people here who are seasoned, you know, I apologize for presuming that I can give any advice that you it's worth your time. But some of the younger ones maybe will find something useful. Okay, so that's about the talk, and that's about why I think I can even consider giving this talk. Okay, the second part, of course. So now we come to the agenda. The agenda is very simple. Basically, I want to give you some advice on how to write good papers, some advice on how to give good talks, and then hopefully I'll get done before the whole hour. I don't think I need that much time, and then we'll talk. You know, you can, you know, probably share things that work for you, and I'll learn from you, and then if I ever have to do this talk again, I'll use those. Okay? So that's basically the agenda. Okay, so here's the process for producing a good paper. So those of you who have cameras, obviously this is a slide to take a picture of, because I'm giving away the secrets of writing a good paper. So you think up a good idea, you think up a good way of evaluating it, you write a convincing paper explaining the idea, you give a talk to induce people to read the paper, and then you grow old and wait for classic paper award. Right? That's it. That's the secret of writing good papers and producing good work. Okay, now for the truth in advertisement, the scope of this talk is I would basically not have much to say about how you are supposed to think up a good idea. Right? No, I mean, you know, I probably can barely do it for my students, but certainly cannot do it for everybody. I mean, certainly cannot presume to do it for everybody. I cannot tell you how to evaluate your great idea. It sort of depends on the areas that you're working in. I certainly cannot tell you how to grow old and wait for a classic paper award, although I do have experience in waiting at any rate. So the stuff that I'm actually going to tell you more about is how to write a convincing paper explaining an idea if you were to be lucky enough to have a good idea, okay? And how to give a talk to induce people to read your paper. That's the part that I'm going to focus on here, okay? Now, one disclaimer, which is that a great idea can eventually transcend even very bad presentation. Okay, some of the greatest ideas were written in obscure places and were written in very inaccessible language, and still, you know, the civilization found them out. Okay, for example, I think those of you here who might know something that's closer to home is optical flow. The idea of optical flow in computer vision was originally published in a reasonably obscure conference. But then when, you know, that didn't stop it from being, you know, very popular then. Okay, so yes, there is a way. So you could say, why the heck do I want to waste my time trying to learn how to write papers well and how to write, give talks well? Many of these things, optical flow guy was still alive when, you know, Bertolt Capehorn was very much alive when his work was discovered. But sometimes this thing might happen after you left the area or after you passed on to another world. So I think posthumous rewards are greatly overrated. Okay, if you want to give me a reward, give me, and I'm alive. Okay, so if you're into, you know, posthumous rewards, then you can ignore how to write good papers and how to give good talks, but otherwise, you know, this might be useful for you. Okay, so my first part is why is, you know, about the papers, and the second part is about the talk. That's what it's going to be. Okay, so the first part, first, before talking about how to write good papers, let me try to tell you, based on my experience in both my own experience as well as, you know, my experience in advising students, why paper writing is actually hard. By the way, there are all sorts of papers one can write. They can write conference papers, they can write journal papers, they can write dissertations, and similarly, there are all sorts of talks one can give. There are conference talks, dissertation talks, journal talks. To make my thing a little more focused, I'll assume it's all about conferences. Since you are in computer science, you know that conferences actually sort of are much more important, you know, in some way, in at least making sure that people know you exist and, you know about your work and so on. Okay, so why is paper writing so hard? I think we tend to think that what is obvious to us is obvious to the reader. The moment, you know, Minsky once said that with understanding comes a sense of loss. And so you got this idea, you understood it yourself, so you assume everybody else understands it. You don't actually go through the steps of explaining how, you know, that idea would make sense to somebody who hasn't gone through the same cognitive process as you. We tend to think that since we wrote term papers, after all, you know, before you start writing your own papers, you would have written term papers, right? Where you read somebody else's paper and summarize it, and you provide some commentary on it. Since we did that, we should be able to write our own papers too. The tricky part there, of course, is that when you are reading somebody else's paper, they have already spent all the time organizing their thoughts in a readable format that pretty much any text summarization would work. And I know that some of the people pressed for time do text summarization of the most primitive kind, cut and paste various paragraphs from various sections and say that's the summary of the paper. Even that would work because somebody else thought about how to write the paper. So when you have your own idea, it hasn't yet been written, and it's a different ballgame altogether. Okay. We tend to focus on the perfection in the small than coherence in the large. People spend lots and lots of time working on small sections, you know, trying to make sure that that particular thing, you know, is very good. It's important, that part is important, but, you know, you need to actually look at the entire paper. You need to look at the coherence of the whole paper. Okay, and that people tend to ignore. At least that's been my experience. And finally, we tend to believe that reader and reviewer has way more patience for spotting diamonds in the rough than we ourselves have. One of the things that we'll see is, I mean, you're all grad students, you know, many of you are grad students, grad students do reviewing. And they are some of the most biting reviewers. You know, when my students review your papers, God forbid. Okay, right. If you have to kind of hope for who should review your paper, hope that somebody, you know, old with major gray hair reviews your paper, because they tend to be more understanding of human foibles than you guys yourself are. So in some sense, you are very critical of papers, and yet you think the people reading your own paper have a lot more patience. Why? You know, why do you expect? They're from the same stock as you are, the humankind. Okay, right. Okay, so these are some of the things that I think make paper writing hard. Okay, now so what are the ways in which we can somehow, you know, improve the writing? You know, here are some of the ideas that I have for you. And then I'll just sort of go through them. Of course, this is like a slide and it keeps coming. So basically, I want you to judge your paper the way you judge your other people's papers, because you are quite strict on that and you should do it that way to yourself. It's not about you, but about your reader's head. Don't be easy on yourself. It's not your English skills. Okay? No hook, no fish. And say no to systematic search over paper configurations. The better the draft, the better the comments. And related work section is not expendable. That's what basically the summary. I'm going to go through each of them one slide at a time, slowly. Okay, so judge your paper the way you judge others. And so I think actually paper writing is a bit like bathroom singing. How many of you have sang songs while taking shower in the bathroom? Right? Don't you think you sound extremely good? I mean, aren't you surprised why you are not getting these sold out concerts? I mean, you sound so damn good, right? Something in this vapor, water vapor, makes you feel as if you sound really, really good. So one time, you know, take one of these little recorders and record yourself. And then listen to it afterwards. And then you will cringe, right? Right? So beginning researchers tend to write some of the most cutting reviews, as I said, okay? And yet, they seem to be too nice on their own papers. That's a kind of a paradox. If you are critical of your own papers, you won't write that by a paper. Again, I'm assuming all of you are writing good papers and most of this, you know, advice is sort of redundant for you, but it's for those losers who still have to learn. So you can summarize this, you know, to your friends, you know, when you go back. Okay, so and yet seem to be too nice on their own papers. This is sort of what happens in the bathroom singing, right? So when you are singing, there is basically you sound extremely good and you're surprised why you're not getting these sold out concerts, and yet, you know, somehow you're not getting all these calls to sing in public, okay? But there is a remedy for bathroom singing, it turns out. As I said, you know, record yourself and listen to it for an eminently cringeworthy experience, for most of you at any rate. I'm sure some of you are really good singers. Me, if I do it, you know, I think I'll cringe. myself. Okay, do the same thing for the paper. Do the same thing for your paper. You know, read the paper as if it is written by somebody else. Read the paper as if you are reviewing it to decide whether it should get into the conference or not. Because after all, if I can delude your mind into thinking that it's somebody else's paper, you would be really, really critical. It's not that you don't know how to critique. It is that you suspend the critique component while you are generating your paper. Okay, and obviously if you're too critical, you won't even write a single sentence. So, you know, first write something. But then, you know, when you are looking at it, when you're looking at the draft, try to think of it as if it is somebody else's paper. This actually becomes very important because ultimately it is in fact, A, it should be understood by anybody, not just you. And B, it is about somebody else's cognitive state. We'll get to that too. So you need to understand whether somebody other than you can understand this paper. The best way to do it is to think of this as somebody else's paper and you're just a reviewer. Okay? So that, I think, is a useful thing. It's a hard skill to acquire, but I think that's the most useful thing you can do. Okay? And of course, one other thing somebody might say is, hey, if I become a nice reviewer, from tomorrow onwards, I accept everybody's paper to each guy, then I don't have to write better papers. Right, it's, you know, it's like logically, if the problem is that you are a hard reviewer and you're not being hard on yourself, you might think maybe I shouldn't be judgmental. But I do want you to be judgmental, you know, because I think we have to write what we are writing in a clear way. So do be judgmental, continue to be judgmental, just also be judgmental about your own writing. And I'm just saying you have that testing, you know, component already in your head, because I know most of you have reviewed papers and most of you know how to critique. Okay. The second one is, it's not about your head, but the head of your readers. Again, something that is easy to forget. Okay, when you're reading the paper, you should, even if it's your paper, you have to put yourself completely in the shoes of the reader, not about yourself. And it's again a very hard thing to do, but you have to remind yourself, like ultimately many times. I want to give you an example. In this particular case, my own example. This is the very first paper that I ever wrote that got published in ICRA as well as in, this is actually a robotics journal, IEEE robotics journal version. And this is my MS thesis. And when I started writing the technical report for this, of course, before you write the technical report and then, you know, my advisor said, hey, let's just send it to the journal also. So I remember writing, you know, Larry Davis was my advisor then, and I remember writing what I thought was a nice, crisply stated, you know, self-contained, you know, report of what I have done. Okay, it just so happened that I also used a lot of italics in my writing. Now the italics, unfortunately, it turned out as later on, they had a lot of significance for me. I could say when we are doing this and then put it in italics, magically I know which this I'm talking about. And if I say it, I know again what it I'm talking about. So I use lots and lots of italics. And if I have a word, I mean, if I have a phrase that has special significance for me, I put it in italics. Larry Davis' only comment was, remove the italics. Right? So I thought the poor guy doesn't like italics. You know, must be, you know, he likes Times Roman font. So I just removed the italics and I tried to read my paper. The magic is gone. Because it no longer made any sense to me either. You see what I'm saying? I read the thing and I said, what happened to my paper? You know, the moment I removed the italics, the meaning is gone. Because all the special meanings that I have attached as semantic attachments to these italics, which nobody else has, also disappeared for me. And so then I spent like N plus one drafts, you know, for the rest of my MS thesis, rewriting until it made sense. Okay? So I'm just saying that it's very easy to write in such a way that it makes complete sense to you and doesn't make sense to anybody else. And you almost have to train yourself. You have to read it as if it's about somebody else's cognitive state. You know, in the middle of the paper, if you suddenly start referring to something that hasn't been explained earlier, but you know it because you know the whole work. You know, you won't see, if you just see the paper from your own perspective, you won't see there is any problem. But your reader would be completely confused. Okay. So, in fact, Wittgenstein, the same guy, actually also said the following thing. If a lion could talk, we cannot understand him. Just because you write it in English doesn't mean your reader can understand you. What makes us understand each other is shared experiences. And in case of paper, you need to bring your reader to your cognitive state to some extent. Otherwise, they are lost. Okay, so you need to try to do that. And again, these are obvious things, you know, that's part of, you know, some of these things, but they are hard to follow, essentially. Okay, so try to track the cognitive state of your reader and make sure that they are ready to understand what you are about to say. That's what you need to do when reviewing your own paper. Okay, otherwise it's going to be an issue. Okay, the next one is, don't be easy on yourself, it's not your English skill. How many of you are not native English speakers? Okay, right. One of the nice things for you guys is, if your paper is not well written, you can say, it's because I'm not a native English speaker. Right? I mean, these English guys, they have easy, you know, somehow for some historical accident, English became lingua franca for scientific community. And we, most of us are just as fluent in it as we are in French, right? And so it's easy to convince yourself that, you know, I mean, really, I could have written just as good a paper as anybody else, as understandable a paper as anybody else. It's just that English is not my language. You know, I speak Chinese, in my case, I speak Telugu, and some of you speak Chinese, some of you speak something else, maybe some of you speak British English, that's also hard to understand. And so the point is, it's very easy to convince yourself that that's the issue. I mean, so it's like some of the, you know, obviously, it's one of the beautiful things about and research in general, and computer science research and AI research in particular, is it's so international, it's so diverse, and we had to pick some language. English became the lingua franca, but it's just great that lots and lots of different cultures and different languages, people with different languages, backgrounds, write papers. But we should avoid giving ourselves an easy way out, saying, oh, it's the English is my problem. You know, it's not. Okay? If in no language can you write badly organized papers. No language that I know of. Any human language requires organization of thought. Okay? Organization of a paper, organization of clarity of your ideas is quite different from knowing the language. So if it really, really matters to you, write it in Chinese first, translate it to English. That would be better than most papers that are badly written. Because they would just have syntactically bad English but semantically good organization. Think about that. Okay, so I think just don't give yourself an easy way out by saying it's an English issue, it's not the organizational issue. Often organizing the thoughts appropriately is quite different from foreign language issue, unless your language is a computer language and you're not a human, in which case I don't know what to say. But, but for humans, all humans basically expect organization of thought. And so, you know, I think you have basically lost that as an excuse. Ask yourself if you did a good job on organization, and be very tough on yourself. And, you know, it's this idea of randomly writing something and giving it to the staff English checker to check English, it's useless. Because English checkers will check whether it's syntactically correct sentence, and the overall paragraph is probably not going anywhere. The overall paper is gone long back. And that is completely up to you. You need to deal with the organization yourself. And one other thing I always say is, there should be surprise in the paper. People should be surprised at your paper. But there are good surprises and bad surprises. The bad surprise is, right after introduction you put conclusion. That will be surprise. But the good surprise is a seemingly easy idea that everybody has overlooked for such a long time actually beats the heck out of something that is requires 18 pages to describe. That's the good surprise. Those are the things that give you the best paper awards, in some sense. Right? Because you have found something that's technically very interesting. But in explaining that, you can put the wrong kind of surprises, and then the paper won't get it. Because again, humans have to read it. So aim for content surprises, but don't at all tolerate organizational surprises. Those are bad, because those just will kill your paper. Okay, the next is no hook, no fish, or no claims, no readers. Okay, beginning writers, beginning students, at least mine were, they tend to be just very defensive about making any claims in the paper. Okay, what if, you know, I start off brashly claim that my paper has a contribution, then people might actually think, you know, I'm presumptuous, and then they get very critical of me. So this is part of the belief that the nail that sticks out gets hammered. Okay, so there are a whole bunch of papers, none of which make any, claims of contributions. Yours makes a claim of contribution. Maybe the reviewers will wake up and check whether your paper is good or bad. Okay, and that's sort of obviously the wrong kind of a thinking, because at least those of you who reviewed papers, you know that if the paper doesn't grab your attention, you are not even going to the second page. Right? I mean, most of you know how the reviewing works. I mean, there's good reviewing. We can talk about good reviewing talk. But we are human, and if the paper doesn't grab your attention, you're probably not going to the 15th section, or find out the proof details and so on. So you do need to, and one way of grabbing attention is actually saying exactly why this paper is interesting. Make claims, not outlandish claims, claims about the paper that actually, the paper does actually substantiate. My point is, students tend to underplay their contributions because that it might be seen as sort of just too brash. I think that's something that you want to avoid. Okay, as I said, so without claims, no one pays any attention anyway. And I think, like, for conference papers at any rate, introduction is the most important paper of your conference, of your paper. You probably have to write it multiple times. You write something in the beginning, but rewrite it until you make sure that it reflects what are the true contributions of the paper. It reflects why the paper is worth reading for this reviewer who has to read another 10 papers other than yours. Okay, so I think it's a very important thing, and I would actually spend a lot of time making sure that pretty much anybody would be drawn by the force of the argument of the introduction. And then, of course, if you draw attention to yourself and you don't deliver, yes, your paper won't get in. But if you don't draw attention to yourself and hope that people will just let your paper in, you know, by sort of a random pass, that's a losing strategy. I mean, you shouldn't be in that kind of a business. Okay, the next one I want to say no to systematic search over paper configurations, and also no to local evaluation over paper coherence. Okay, and let me just say that again slowly. This is a negative thing. So don't try to consider all possible variations of how to write the paper. It's just impossible. There are infinite number of variations of how to write your paper. Okay, it pretty much, the only thing that works is write and rewrite. Okay, so it's a local search. Those of you are all of you are in AI, and you know local search. You don't do A star search for paper writing. You write local search. Okay, you have a complete version, and then you write. And that also means that be ready to rewrite, not just revision, you know, refinement. You know, and those of you again from AI, all of you are in AI. Refinement means adding more detail without changing the overall configuration. Okay, revision means giving everything up and rewriting from scratch if needed. You need to be ready. You need to be ready to rewrite your paper when it's not satisfactory to you, when you read it as if it is somebody else's paper. Don't have too much of a commitment to your paper. I mean, the Laurie Eirig story is one of my early students. You know, she would be a much more methodical person, and she would have everything completely set up in writing. And then I would be rewriting the introduction, rewriting multiple sections with 1 hour to go before Federal Express deadline arrives. She, as I said, she is one of my older students. She's not old, but, you know, I was younger then. And then we used to submit papers by sending them by FedEx to the IIII office or HKI office. And so I would just wait until the last minute, rewriting everything. And I did it myself, okay? And of course, she would have large number of heart attacks. The good news is she did survive. She's still alive, and she's doing quite well today. But you have to be ready. You have to revise, not just refine. Refine is a bad word. Refine basically means I'm stuck to my way of explaining the overall organization of the paper. I just make the font of the 15th equation of the fourth page different, and then pat myself on the back, saying it all looks good now. Doesn't. Okay? So you have to be ready to revise, not just refine. And so again, as I said, look for local search. And the second part is, while you do not want to do global search on paper configurations, you do not want to do local evaluation on paper coherence. It's an opposite part. Okay? It's not enough to just read one section of the paper and say that looks good. I mean, I understand you have to do that, but every once in a while before the paper is submitted, you have to sit and read the entire paper for coherence. It's very easy to keep, you know, lose track of coherence of the paper, because again the problem is you know everything about your work. Unless you stole it from somebody else, you know everything about your work. Okay, and so you think that as you're reading the seventh section, you know exactly what context it is coming in. But if you read the entire paper, that's what the reader is going to read. They don't read your mind, they read your paper. And you need to understand the coherence of the paper. So the next thing I'm about to say will give away my age. I still am very much into reading the paper away from the computer. Okay, I understand you guys are so good that you can read it on your cell phone, right? but you are deluding yourself. Okay, the reason you don't want to read it on the cell phone, by the way, has nothing to do with the fact that you can't read small print, but because you essentially are going to not be able to resist the temptation of making the change as soon as you find a problem with the paper. You have to prioritize your changes to your paper. Read the entire paper while making changes. For me, what works is making changes with a pen and the paper. And you can use iPad, writing tool or something. Just resist the urge of making, oh, the T-H-E is spelled T-E-H. Let me just correct it right now. Then I've done something. That's useless. When the entire introduction is not going anywhere, you wasted your time correcting this first. Plus, while you are reading it, you want your entire paper to be in your head at the same time. And this business of interleaving little change with little reading would just disrupt your own thought process about your paper. So do something that will get you away from the urge to change the paper as soon as you are reading it. Read it fully end to end and then make the changes. I think that works better, much better. Okay, a couple of other things before we go into the talk part. So the better the draft, the better the comments. Okay, so you all have advisors. You all obviously will write some stuff and give it to the advisor to read it, and they'll give you some comments. The question, of course, is shall I give a poorly written first draft or a more polished fifth draft? Or just give it the day the 1 hour before it's ready for submission? Which one should I do, right? I mean, it's a tricky question. Obviously, the one thing I want you to remember, obviously, I mean, put yourself in your advisor's shoes. If you give a paper that so badly lacks in organization and so badly lacks in any kind of a syntax, then the people reading the paper will spend time correcting the organization and the syntax. If on the other hand you spend some of your own time dealing with the organizational part, then you may be able to get much more useful comments. But just don't get mad at your advisor when they say cut this whole section. Okay, that's okay. You spent your best effort in explaining your idea, and now I look at it and I say, no, I think this is not the way to explain it. If you just write bad English, I will be correcting your bad English. If you write bad organization, I will be correcting your bad organization. So use the advisor as a useful tool, you know, and give them a proper amount of background. Okay. This story, that one of my favorite stories, is one of my own students, Sean Long, who did his master's with me. And I remember, you know, he wrote this paper, the very first draft. It was so nice, I basically said, it was great. Because just before him was another somebody else's draft, which was so full of organizational and English issues that it wasn't good. Okay, so I gave him a reasonable number of comments, and then he gave me a second draft taking these into account, and I get lots and lots of comments to change the paper. And he got mad at me. He said, the first draft was already good, how come the second draft became worse? Am I going wrong direction? No, you're not going in wrong direction. If your paper is good, I'll spend more time reading it and giving you more useful comments. That is the paradox of DD. Okay, only when your paper is actually readable can people give you comments about the actual content. If it's not readable, they're focusing on the readability. Okay, so take that into consideration. And then the last one is actually not just about papers, but it's also about being a good scholar, okay, related work section. Too many conferences still basically combine related work in the page count, and they have too few pages, and you think there are great ideas that you want to explain that require double the size of the paper. And so what happens just before the camera ready version of the paper, you cut down the related work, I mean, and the citations to maybe just yourself and your advisor's work. Okay, that's not a great idea, I think, obviously, because you know, in some sense, in writing papers, not only are you talking about what you have provided, what you have contributed to this body of knowledge, but you are also telling us that you understand a body of area such that I can trust you when you say you extended a piece. Okay, so it's part of being a good scholar is actually to understand what's been done around and then put a proper, put that work properly in perspective. So I think it's very important. I mean, this is not just about writing style, it's about just being a good researcher. I think many conferences, including IJCAI this year, have avoided counting the references out of the page count. I think that's a great idea. We've been pushing for it. Some of us have been pushing for it. ICAPS is doing it. You know, IIII is doing it. But in general, think of it as the more you understand the influence of others' work on your work and explain it, and explain the your own perspective, that doesn't reduce your contribution. It only makes it deeper. Okay. So don't be worried that if I somehow cite this other person's work, somehow people will think I've done more incremental work. No. Okay, and so that's one probably slightly different in tone from the rest of the advice, but I think it's also quite important. Okay, so we're done for the paper part. So these are just a summary of my maxims. You know, judge your paper the way you judge others. It's not about your head, but about your reader's head. Don't be easy on yourself. It's not your English skills. It's really your organizational skills. Organization of the paper, organization of your thought process. No hook, no fish. If you don't claim, I won't read. Okay? You have to claim why I should read your paper. Say no to systematic search over paper configurations, and say no to local evaluation over paper coherence. Okay? And the better the draft, the better the comments. That's paradoxical, but that's true. Okay? If you give me a badly written draft, I will put a couple of spelling checks and then give it back to you. You may as well ask Microsoft Word, and it does it free for you. Okay? Related work section is not expendable. So that's about my first part. Part two is maxims for talks. Okay. So I'll use somewhat the same structure, but it's shorter because some of the issues have already been covered in the paper part. Why is it hard to give good talks? Okay. First thing is when we give talks, tend to be quite defensive. And if you're not, of course, it's great for you. We tend to be defensive and assume that somehow you have to reprove in front of the entire audience that your paper didn't get in because of a fluke. In fact, you had enough math, enough proofs, enough details that you did, you know, actually deserve your getting in. Okay, that's being overly defensive. The reviewing process worked. Your paper is in. Okay, the talk really is about convincing me to read your paper. Okay, so don't be defensive. Tell me why I should read your paper, not that you have every detail worked out. You can't do it given we are reducing the size of the talk length to smaller and smaller length, which by the way is not all that bad because you're all Twitter generation. You can't actually understand more than 140 characters, at least my kids don't. Okay, so you want things done like very fast, and so conference talks basically cannot possibly go into details, and if you make the trade-off of going into too much details, then you're just being way too defensive. Okay, you need to use that as an advertisement. So it's not the case that the more technical, the better for the talk. Okay? There's other reason why giving good talks is hard, especially again in conferences, is we spend way too much time crafting the PowerPoint with exquisite animation. Did you see I didn't have any exquisite animation? I mean, the best I had is I have figured out after all my career that I can say appear and things appear. That's about it. You know, whereas my students have things which move in all sorts of interesting directions, etc. I'm not saying that's not good. That's very important. But given a certain amount of time, you have to decide how much time are you spending crafting your PowerPoint and thinking about what that PowerPoint is going to say and thinking about what you're going to say in front of the audience. Okay, if you do anything less than 50-50, you are on the wrong track. You do need to understand what the talk is going to say, not just how beautiful your slides are. We don't recognize the enormous cognitive toll conferences extract on the audience, and this is very ironic. We are in the business of understanding human intellect, right? I mean, we are artificial intelligence. We're going to just get rid of people and make computers take care of, you know, doing all the human things. Right. Now, so the interesting thing is that conferences are very hard on audience. Have you ever seen outside of a conference room where the talks are going on? That's where all the people are, not in the inside. Why? Because it's extremely hard to quickly change your mind from one topic to another topic every 15 minutes. You, the audience, I'm not talking about myself, you, the audience. Now, when you come here, you suddenly think, now it will be different. People will somehow understand what I'm saying, even though the guy before me said something completely different. You have to be aware of the cognitive burden you are placing on the listeners. And that would make you give better talks, as I'll explain to you in a minute. Okay? So you tend to kind of misunderstand, tend not to understand the cognitive toll conferences extract from the audience, especially afternoon talks like this. Great time to catch up in your sleep. Okay? And every 15 minutes, new talk, so it's like having songs in the background while you fall asleep. Okay? And then we tend to talk to ourselves. How many people, you know, I'm sure none of you do this, but for the rest of the conference, see how many people stand like this, looking at their thing and talking to it, as if all the action is right here. No, all the action is right there. You have to talk to the audience. Otherwise, why waste your time coming all the way here? I mean, I think Beijing is great, you know, you should just go to Great Wall, for example. You know, why hang around giving the talk here? Right? So we should not talk to ourselves. It's about, again, other people's heads, not about your head. Okay, so that's basic. And then, and finally, we just have heard way too many boring talks in our lives. Okay, if you have got to any conferences, you have seen people, old people with gray hair droning on and on and on, and these are old people with gray hair. They should know better. They must be knowing better. This is probably how conference talks should be. They're supposed to be boring. So I want to be boring too. Right? So those are, I think, some of the reasons why conference talks, it's hard to give good conference talks. Now what the maxims be for the ones that I could, you know, arrange for you? These are the four. Why and what is more important than how? Okay. Slides are a prop. You are the main show. Okay. Track the knowledge state of your audience. And then show conspicuous enthusiasm for your work. Those are the things. Of course, a lot of things from the paper side also, you know, carry over, but these are some of the things. Okay, let me go through this. Why and what is more important than how? So a talk is not to explain every little thing, especially conference talks. Even job talks are not, but definitely a conference talk is not about explaining every little detail that you have figured out. So that's what the paper is for. Okay, it's supposed to be a 15 to 20 minute advertisement to get the people to read your paper. You know, how many papers are there in Litchkai proceedings? It becomes extremely easy these days. You know, and when I was younger, they would give these many proceedings, books. Now this is where it is all. So you think, there are not that many papers. It's, you know, we have taken care of all of this. But really, there are lots and lots of papers here. You are, you know, as much as, you know, those of you who have papers in the main track have to be commended because you have gotten through some rigorous reviewing process and have had their paper published, you still have to compete for attention of the readers. How many people are actually going to read the stuff in this? And you're likely to read the stuff in this if the talk was a good advertisement for the paper and you want to figure out why. Okay, leave some suspense for people. You don't have to go into every little detail, but make sure they understand why the paper is, why are you doing this paper? Why is this problem important given what already exists? And what exactly are you trying to accomplish? Those are more important than exactly how did you prove the fourth theorem. Exactly how did you set up a particular paper. I mean, I'm not saying they're not important. It's just a question of priorities. You know, any talk in conferences where the speaker gets into the technical details in the third slide or fourth slide is a gone case. I mean, third slide is okay. It's like the first 30 seconds is a gone case. Because in fact, many a time people are shifting sessions. They probably want to hear your talk and they're walking clear across the hall to come to your talk, and they came 3 minutes later into your talk. And if you don't have a hope, you don't give them a hope of catching up, then you lost an audience that came. Okay? So as I said, they can always read up the how details, but they won't bother checking out the paper if you don't understand why and what. That's ultimately the point of the talk. Again, as I said, if one person somehow can understand, I had a student, he was actually in one of the pictures, Will Cushing, you know, is a great guy. He has this amazing ability to avoid atmospherics and understand however you speak, you know, however dull or, you know, very interesting your talk is, he'll understand what you're doing. And he will figure it out, and then he can maybe cite it, and maybe other people will start citing your work because of that. But do you want to bet on Will Cushing being there in your audience all the time? You want to bet on normal people being there, and you want to make sure that they understand why you're doing the work. Okay, the next one, of course, is slides are a prop. You really are the main show about a talk, honestly. You know, we are humans. I mean, more than even the papers, talks are an interactive thing. You know, when I'm talking, you're not all just looking at the slides. And the slides are not particularly well made. I mean, I just use the same exact boring black color everywhere. Okay, to the extent I can keep your attention, it has to be what I'm saying, not just what's on the slide. And you have to keep that in your mind. So mediocre slides with a great speaker, any day trumps great slides with a mediocre speaker by a huge amount. By a huge amount. Of course, great slides with great speaker, great. Okay, but if you have to, you know, schedule your time as to, do I think about what I'm saying and how I'm saying it versus, you know, do I spend the next 2.5 hours improving the animation in the PowerPoint, please think about what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. Okay, that's much more important. Okay, as I said, 50-50 at least is what I think, but, you know, sometimes you can interleave it at a fine grain. You may be able to both change slides while still thinking about the global organization of the talk. But I would spend a lot of time thinking about where your talk is going. And here are two very small things I always keep telling my students. After the initial slide, large number of people, in fact, you can do this as an exercise and, you know, come and tell me on Friday, how many talks you have attended had as their second slide overview. Okay, the first slide will be the name of the paper. The second slide would be overview with 59 bullets. Right? Useless. Completely useless. Are the readers in a cognitive state to understand the overview? Did you see where my overview came? I'm not necessarily saying mine is a good talk, but at least I tried to not put overview in the upfront. You need to know what I'm going to say before you will understand the overview of the talk. Okay, so don't waste your time putting overview as the first, you know, very first, you know, slide after the title slide. And similarly, the other thing that I find funny and I tell all my students is, there is this, you know, again, count this also on until Friday. How many speakers end their talk with a big thanks, questions, and an empty slide? Do you think their slide is any different from the thanks, questions, question mark from the previous guy's slide? No, they're all the same. People have no idea what we are supposed to ask questions about. Leave as the last slide the summary of your work while you are taking questions. It's a very minor thing. You see what I'm saying? Okay, because you want to keep them a prop to ask you questions. Okay, leave that. You know, again, because people do it that I'm suggesting this. My students certainly do it. Okay, track the knowledge state of your audience. Talk to the audience, not to yourself. Look at people's faces. Even in a conference, even at 3:30 in the evening, there should be a couple of people who are trying to follow you. Otherwise, you wasted your flight ticket. Come all the way here. Okay? Look at somebody's face and try to see if everybody is falling asleep, leave the room. It's okay. Nobody will miss you. Okay? Right? So look at the audience. Talk to the audience, not to yourself. Keep track of the picture you are painting in their heads. Help them catch up with the talk if they suddenly had to check their email. One of the nice things about this conference, thank goodness, internet doesn't seem to work well. So you are likely to understand more of the talks because you can't check on your email, right? Okay, however, in many conferences, the internet works and people are checking away their email, and then suddenly as they're about to hear you, a ping, they look at their email, then they look up, they lost you. Don't ever make your talk such that people can't get in. Imagine driving, you know, putting a, you know, highway from Beijing to Shanghai where it only has one entry point at Beijing and one exit point at Shanghai. A gone case. You need to be able to allow people to come in the middle. They certainly will leave in the middle. You know, you don't need to worry about that. You need to allow people to come in the middle. And the way to do that is, you know, start off going back and making connections to what you said. Once in a while, repeat. It's okay. You say, as I said in the beginning of the talk, or something. Give something to people, because it's again comprehension of humans, not of machines. And they're just like you. Okay? Explicitly make backward and forward references to give the audience a chance to recover their bearings, because otherwise, especially in conferences, you're gone. Okay? The last, show conspicuous enthusiasm for your work. You spent a lot of time writing the paper. You spent a lot of time rewriting the paper for the camera ready. You spent a lot of time buying the tickets and coming here. The Great Wall excursion is only on Friday or Saturday. The whole reason you are here is to give the talk. Okay, that's the culmination. It's not just somehow something that you go through. And you want to take it that way. You want to show enthusiasm, you know, about your work. It's very important to be enthusiastic. Humans can sense enthusiasm. Machines don't. So machines have to somehow be given this affect, you know, when HCI is full of, you know, showing, you know, getting how to, you know, machines to show the kind of normal emotions that we show. But when we're giving conference talks, we tend to act like machines and not show any emotion, not show any, you know, enthusiasm, lest people might think you somehow are too smitten with your work. That's not at all good. Okay, now you might say, if everybody shows enthusiasm for their work, and if everybody is jumping around, okay, well, maybe it won't be much of a difference. You know, the inverse document frequency, IDF, would be zero then. But you don't need to worry. Really. You don't need to worry. If you show enthusiasm for your talk in this conference, I'll tell you, you will be in a chosen minority. Right? Because most people just get through the motions. Okay, and hope to somehow not say anything, not raise their voice, not modulate it, and don't tell me it has anything to do with any language. I'm sure that every language has modulation, every language has enthusiasm, every language. We're all human. Just language is a small detail. Okay, so show enthusiasm for your work, because people sense your enthusiasm. And one of the reasons that is important is, as I said, they have to have a reason to wake up from their deep sleep. They've been sleeping in the afternoon. Or they're outside anyway. If they're outside, you're lost. Okay. But, and in fact, if you show enthusiasm, they might wake up. You know, one of my favorite examples from this is actually a guy called Steve Hanks, who used to work in planning. And when I was just out of grad school, I went to this symposium on planning and replanning at Stanford in 1991. It is about 3:30 in the evening, and for sure people are droning on and on and on, and everybody is getting very good sleep. Okay, and then Steve Hanks comes, and he's just jumping around. It's like an excited molecule, right? So you would just have to at least track him. What's going on? What's going on? And because of which you wake up. If you are awake, you might follow. Okay, I mean, of course, you can overdo this too, but, you know, since nobody else showed any enthusiasm, I still remember, this was 1991, I still remember Steve Hanks' talk that day, because he was, you know, enthusiastic about his work, and he's actually interested in making the audience understand what he did, not just, let me get through these 15 minutes so that I can go to Great Wall. Okay, that's very, very important. And again, avoid this, that somehow if I show enthusiasm, people might start asking me tough questions. If you are ever very worried that people will ask you tough questions, here is a hint. Give all the 15 minutes or 25 minutes, just talk itself, so that they won't have any time for questions. But that's still better than giving a boring talk that will basically nobody will read your paper. Okay? So again, change this idea that the nail that sticks up might be hammered, and show enthusiasm for your work. You know, change the culture of conference afternoons or to catch up on the sleep. Okay, and then you would be in a good shape. Wake them up. So, as I said, what better way to end that part than remind ourselves what Michael Faraday said about his evening talk in Royal Society. His talks were great, you know, everybody loved it. You know, those of the people, you know, who at that time who didn't know anything about physics loved him more for his talks than his physics. Of course, we love him for his physics, okay, because there were no audio recordings of his Royal Society talks. What he said, as I said, is the lecturer should give the audience full reason to believe that all his powers have been exerted for their pleasure and instruction. Why was it that when, I think, what's his name, one of the US Republican presidential candidates, I think Giuliani, once, while he was in the middle of a debate, he took a cell phone call from his wife, right? And that's it, that basically killed his presidential campaign. Why? Because you know that his whole soul is not in giving the talk. When you are talking to yourself and you are not looking at the audience emotions, audience facial expressions, you are doing the exact same thing. So don't expect any better reception to you than to Giuliani. The talk also would be forgotten. Okay, so that's the maxims of the talk. So I'm going to end right now. These are the maxim summary, such as they are for the papers. Judge your paper the way you judge others. It's not about your head, but your reader's head. Okay, and don't be easy on yourself. It's not at all your English skills. You know, somewhat, little bit. That to the extent it's all you're missing is English, believe me, there are a lot of poorly paid people who read badly written English and convert it into better written English. They cannot explain your ideas better than you. They can just convert it. In fact, Google Translate can do it. Right? Okay, it's not about your English skills. It's about your thinking. It's about your thought process. It's about your organizational skills. If you don't claim, nobody will pay any attention, and don't complain. Okay, say no to systematic search over paper configurations, and say no to local evaluation of little sections, you know, exquisite coherence. You have to be, the entire paper has to be coherent. The better the draft, the better the comments, so because people reading it will understand what you're trying to say, then they can give you more, you know, meaningful comments than just saying, you know, put a hyphen here. And related work sections are not at all expendable, because that's how you show you are a scholar, you understand your area, and you have a perspective that you're trying to bring in. In terms of good talks, why and what is more important than how. You know, if you have a large amount of time, even then, go into why and what for the first part of the talk before you go into the small details about how. Okay, the how is what the paper is actually written, and then somebody is going to sit down and read. And if they're going to replicate it, the talk is not going to be enough, obviously. In fact, a 6-page conference paper is also not going to be enough. Okay, it's a series of abstractions of the great work you have done. But if you don't give a good talk, they'll never actually open this CD to look your paper up. Okay. Track the knowledge state of your audience. Understand where they are in the talk. You know, do they remember what you have said? You know, if not, if too many people look lost, try to make backward forward pointers. That's part of important in papers too. And then finally, show conspicuous enthusiasm to your work. At the minimum, you should be enthusiastic about your work. All of you can make a lot more money than doing PhD. You know, I know your advisors will yell at me, but it's true. Okay, you chose to do PhD, you chose to write papers, it's because you're so enthusiastic about your work. Why mask it? You know, it will help reception of your work. Thanks for your attention. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So one of the comments you made is that at the end, last slide, you recommended that we put summary points to help engage the audience in asking questions. My colleagues and I, we have a tendency to put our
future work
information about ourselves to look for postdocs.
Yeah, no, that's not a good idea. I know NICTA does this. I know NICTA does this, exactly. Are you from NICTA by any chance?
No.
Okay. I want this to be there. This is a capsule summary of what I told you. I don't expect miracles. I don't expect that I made sense to you for a whole entire hour. Okay, and that you remember exactly what I said at what minute. So there should be some cognitive prosthetic that helps you get back and ask questions. The most embarrassing thing is not to have any questions, you know, after your talk. That's why, you know, I went all the way to 225, so that even if there are no questions, I'll be fine. Okay, but, you know, you need some help. And if they, in fact, Recently somebody else did this, and the only questions they had is, so can you tell me about nectar? And that's pretty embarrassing too. My talk is not about nectar. Okay? Any other questions?
Okay, have a question?
Yes, sir.
I would have an observation about the language part of your talk. I think that you're very right. Of course, an article or a paper written badly in any language is still bad, but I think there is a real handicap for a non-native speaker of English to actually go to the level of these conferences where, and I agree with you, but we are supposed to take into account the fact that sometimes phrases are put differently in other languages. I'm taking this example. In French guys, they don't really like the short phrases as in English.
Mm-hmm.
In English, they do lots of repetition. If you're talking about the same thing, you use the same words, short sentences, right to the point, great. You do that in French, they don't understand it. They don't like repetition, they like long phrases. And I think that the handicap is a lot bigger than just structuring. Even the structuring can be language dependent to a certain level.
I do not believe that structure would be language dependent, and I say it from experience, because I spoke Telugu for my first 12 years of schooling, so much so that when I went to my undergraduate school, when somebody said hi to me, I had to stop in tracks, understand what they said, convert it into Telugu, which is my language, produce a response to it, and then convert it into English, and by that time the guy who said hi was about a furlong away. Okay? So I know what I'm talking about. Okay? I understand, but the reality is it will never be the case that if it's not your native language, for example, you know, I think Yeats said, for example, that, you know, about Rabindranath Tagore, who's like a Nobel Prize winning poet from India, that if you are not, you know, if you did not grow up with that language, if you are not a native speaker, you shouldn't attempt to write poetry in a language. I agree, you shouldn't write poetry in English. You know, I should probably certainly not write poetry in English. But we are writing papers, and all I'm worried about is people tend to give themselves too much of a leeway. That they should avoid. I realize that eventually I can never write, I mean, since you said French, maybe you're a French guy, in which case I can never write as nicely with the turn of phrase, etc., in French as you can write, but I think I can give myself, you know.
No, I totally agree with you. I'm not saying that we should give certainly not. It's not about the language. But there is this extra level.
Yes, it is.
There is this is an extra step that needs to be taken. And it happened to all non-native speakers, I think, to have papers rejected just because the English didn't sound right to the reviewer. I mean, you get the board reviewer, he has 20 articles.
Yeah.
He gets onto your article.
But
except,
who are the reviewers? Who are the reviewers? In each guy, do you know what is the percentage of speakers, reviewers whose native language is English? I'm an area chair. I'm not a native speaker. You know, so there are a large percentage of reviewers who are also coming from different cultures. So there is some self-correcting mechanism for that. And also that's why we have SPC members, area chairs, etc. Again, I agree. I'm not trying to completely downplay the notion of language. I'm just saying I found my students, especially non-native speakers, giving themselves way too much of a, you know, this thing, saying, oh, it's not, English is my language, not my language. You know, at least Rav acts as if it's his language, so let him write the whole thing. That's not useful. You know, you need to explain your idea first.
I have a second question, if I'm more like a question.
Sure.
I guess you have also teaching activity next to your research activity. Do you find that teaching helps in presentation?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. I mean, indeed, because, you know, I think especially anybody who has taught can give good talks. I mean, but then anybody who taught badly can still give bad talks. You know, that's a different story. Because the way I think about it is many, many, you know, teaching episodes are a bunch of students who would rather not be in the class. I think you actually wanted to be here. So if I can't, I mean, it should be easier to get you interested in what I'm saying than it should be for my students. And if I can make them interested, of course I can make you interested. Mostly it reduces my tension. Still I have nightmares about giving talks. Okay? I mean, in fact, I think that anything you are reasonably good at, believe it or not, I have no nightmares about basketball playing. My ability to play basketball sucks. And still I have no nightmares about it. I never worry whether I'll do well tomorrow or not, because I'm so bad at it. There's no hope. Okay, if you are any good at anything, you will have nightmares about it. And if you don't have nightmares, probably you are kind of not considering it at all. Okay, so I think at least that's what I tell myself when I had, for example, a nice nightmare today and woke up late and missed the morning. Okay, But I think, you know, the teaching certainly does matter.
Okay, one more quick question.
So one could advise always gave me. Was, you know, the structure of the talk is, you know, tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them, and tell them what you told them.
Exactly.
And the first part sort of suggests that you might want to have a slide at the end of the intro with key lessons. Right? If you follow the script afterwards, if you get confused, here the takeaway.
Exactly.
Slide that I want you to remember of the talk.
That's completely, I agree. I mean, I think I've done that. I did not write it specifically as a point, but you give as many cognitive, you know, aids to the reader as possible to come back right into the talk, even if they lost you in the middle. Okay, I think it's a great point that it is indeed, I mean, that's like a very well-known saying that in any paper or a talk, you tell them what you're telling them, what you're going to tell them, and then tell them, and then tell them that you did say that. But in fact, some people even put a loop around it. You know, keep doing this for pretty much every section. And, you know, helping people understand what you are saying is not a bad thing. If you lose a little bit of space in your 6-page paper, because you got a few more people to understand your paper, you should be happy, not sad. Okay, because the more people understand what you're saying, both in paper and in talk, the better off you are. Okay, and if they have questions, they'll ask. The loss is the people who did not even ask you questions because they couldn't care about what you said. They didn't know you were there. And again, with all due respect, in this great conference, there will be many sessions you will go to and you would have no idea what happened just now. Because the speaker did not want to be there, the audience had better things to do, such as checking emails, you know, and, you know, everybody just, the thing went away. And it's a valuable time. We spent all this time physically to be present. We want to exploit it. This is the culmination of your paper writing, not just a chore.
Okay.
Thank you.